January the 5th, 1949, and the American Broadcasting Company opens its microphones in the House of Representatives in the capital of the United States to bring you the message of the President of the United States addressed to the 81st Congress, which convened day before yesterday. At the stroke of noon today, each House of Congress was called to order, and after the opening formalities had been dispensed with, each House recessed to go into joint session to receive the President's State of the Union address. At 12:44, the Speaker of the House, Sam Rayburn of Texas, called the House to order on the appearance of the members of the Senate. The representatives rose and applauded their colleagues of the other House. The Speaker then appointed the committee on the part of the House to conduct the President into the House chamber. Selected for the honor were Representatives McCormick of Massachusetts, Doughton of North Carolina, and Martin of Massachusetts. The Senate committee, chosen by Senator Kenneth McKellar of Tennessee, the newly elected President pro tempore of the Senate, were Senators Barkley of Kentucky, Lucas of Illinois, and Wherry of Nebraska. We are now awaiting the arrival of the President, who will be announced by the new doorkeeper of the House, W.R. Fishbate Miller. And the next voice you will hear will be that of doorkeeper Miller. And now, here is doorkeeper Miller.
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
The President is proceeding down the aisle as the members of the House and Senate are standing and applauding. The President pauses now and then to shake a hand, an old friend, and he's smiling very broadly as he proceeds slowly down the aisle into the well of the House. Members are applauding on both sides of the aisle. Now he is shaking hands with Senator McKellar and now with Speaker Rayburn. He turns and is smiling to this vast assembly. There's an overflow of members in the gallery. There's Mrs. Truman and Margaret, Mr. and Mrs. Clark Clifford, and the President is turning from side to side and smiling to everyone. The President will be introduced by Speaker Sam Rayburn of Texas as soon as the ovation subsides. And now here is the gavel.
Members of the Congress, I have the distinguished honor of presenting the President of the United States.
Mr. Speaker, members of the Congress, I am to this 81st Congress that the State of the Union is good. Our nation is better able than ever before to meet the needs of the American people and to give them their fair chance in the pursuit of happiness. This great republic is foremost among the nations of the world in the search for peace. During the last 16 years, our people have been creating a society which offers new opportunities for every man to enjoy his share of the good things of life. In this society, we are conservative about the values and principles which we cherish, but we are forward-looking in protecting those values and principles, and in extending their benefits. We have rejected the discredited theory that the fortunes of the nation should be in the hands of a privileged few. We have abandoned the trickle-down concept of national prosperity. Instead, we believe that our economic system should rest on a democratic foundation and that wealth should be created for the benefit of all. The recent election shows that the people of the United States are in favor of this kind of society and want to go on improving it. The American people have decided that poverty is just as wasteful and just as unnecessary as preventable disease. We've pledged our common resources to help one another in the hazards and struggles of individual life. We believe that no unfair prejudice or artificial distinction should bar any citizen of the United States of America from an education or from good health or from a job that he is capable of performing. The attainment of this kind of society demands the best efforts of every citizen in every walk of life, and it imposes increasing responsibilities on the government. The government must work with industry, labor, and the farmers in keeping our economy running at full speed. The government must see that every American has a chance to obtain his fair share of our increasing abundance. These responsibilities go hand in hand. We cannot maintain prosperity unless we have a fair distribution of opportunity and a widespread consumption of the products of our factories and farms. Our government has undertaken to meet these responsibilities. We have made tremendous public investments in highways, hydroelectric power projects, soil conservation, and reclamation. We have established a system of social security. We have enacted laws protecting the rights and the welfare of our working people and the income of our farmers. These federal policies have paid for themselves many times over. They have strengthened the material foundations of our democratic ideals. Without them, our present prosperity would be impossible. Reinforced by these policies, our private enterprise system has reached new heights of production. Since the boom year of 1929, while our population has increased by only 20%, our agricultural production has increased by 45%, and our industrial production has increased by 75%. We are turning out far more goods and more wealth per worker than we have ever done before. This progress has confounded the gloomy prophets at home and abroad who predicted the downfall of American capitalism. The people of the United States, going their own way, confident in their own powers, have achieved the greatest prosperity the world has ever seen. But great as our progress has been, we still have a long way to go. As we look around the country, many of our shortcomings stand out in bold relief. We are suffering from excessively high prices. Our production is still not large enough to satisfy our demand. Our minimum wages are far too low. Small business is losing ground to growing monopoly. Our farmers still face an uncertain future, and too many of them lack the benefits of our modern civilization. Some of our natural resources are still being wasted. We are acutely short of electric power, although the means for developing such power are abundant. 5 million families are still living in slums and fire traps. 3 million families share their homes with others. Our health is far behind the progress of medical science. Proper medical care is so expensive that it is out of the reach of the great majority of our citizens. Our schools in many localities are utterly inadequate. Our democratic ideals are often thwarted by prejudice and intolerance. Each of these shortcomings is also an opportunity for the Congress and the President to work for the good of the people. Our first great opportunity is to protect our economy against the evils of boom and bust. This objective cannot be attained by government alone. Indeed, the greater part of the task must be performed by individual efforts under our system of free enterprise. We can keep our present prosperity and increase it only if free enterprise and free government work together to that end. We cannot afford to float along ceaselessly on a post-war boom until it collapses. It is not enough merely to prepare to weather a recession if it comes. Instead, government and business must work together constantly to achieve more and more jobs and more production, which mean more and more prosperity for all the people. The business cycle is man-made, and men of goodwill working together can smooth it out. So far as business is concerned, it should plan for steady, vigorous expansion, seeking always to increase its output, lower its prices, and avoid the vices of monopoly and restriction. So long as business does this, it will be contributing to continued prosperity, and it will have the help and encouragement of the government. The Employment Act of 1946 pledges the government to use all its resources to promote maximum employment, production, and purchasing power. This means that the government is firmly committed to protect business and the people against the dangers of recession and against the evils of inflation. This means that the government must adapt its plans and policies to meet changing circumstances. At the present time, our prosperity is threatened by inflationary pressures. At a number of critical points in our economy, the government must be in a position to take effective action at these danger spots. To that end, I recommend that the Congress enact legislation for the following purposes. First, to continue the power to control consumer credit and enlarge the power to control bank credit. Second, to grant authority to regulate speculation on the commodity exchanges. Third, to continue export control authority and to provide adequate machinery for its enforcement. Fourth, to continue the priorities and allocation authority in the field of transportation. Fifth, to authorize priorities and allocations for key materials in short supply. Sixth, to extend and strengthen rent control. Seventh, to provide standby authority to impose price ceilings for scarce commodities, which basically affect essential industrial production or the cost of living, and to limit unjustified wage adjustments, which would force a break in an established price ceiling. Eighth, to authorize an immediate study of the adequacy of production facilities for materials in critically short supply, such as steel, and if found necessary, to authorize government loans for the expansion of production facilities, to relieve such shortages and to authorize the construction of such facilities directly if action by private industry fails to meet our needs. The economic report, which I shall submit to the Congress shortly, will discuss in detail the economic background for these recommendations. One of the most important factors in maintaining prosperity is the government's fiscal policy. At this time, it is essential not only that the federal budget be balanced, but also that there be a substantial surplus to reduce inflationary pressures. And to permit a sizable reduction in the national debt, which now stands at $252 billion. I recommend, therefore, that the Congress enact new tax legislation to bring in an additional $4 billion of government revenue. This should come principally from additional corporate taxes. A portion should come from revised estate and gift taxes. Consideration should be given to raising personal income rates in the middle and upper brackets. We want to keep our economy running in high gear. We must be sure that every group has the incentive to make its full contribution to the national welfare. At present, the working men and women of the nation are unfairly discriminated against by a statute that abridges their rights, curtails their constructive efforts, and hampers our system of free collective bargaining. That statute is the Labor Management Relations Act of 1947, sometimes called the Taft-Hartley Act. That act should be repealed. The Wagner Act should be reenacted. However, certain improvements which I recommended to the Congress 2 years ago are needed. Jurisdictional strikes and unjustified secondary boycotts should be prohibited.